anatomy of the capillaries. You have the endothelial cells. They're going to be held together by tight junctions and desmosomes. And then you have your intracellular clefts, so your gaps of non-joined membrane. So this basically makes like a filter mesh. The small molecules can enter and exit through this area. Three types of capillaries. There's continuous, which is going to be the most common. Cells are going to be joined by tight junctions. And then fenestrated. Fenestrated. How's it right? Cells have pores, so they have fenestra. Sinusoidal is going to be cells that have few junctions and have pores. They tend to look like they have sinuses. Okay. So, continuous, like I said, is the most common. This is where they're going to be joined at the edges. You're going to get the pinocytotic vesicles that are going to be either uptaking or depositing fluids from one side to the other. Okay, this is the filter. The filter is the actual, it has to go through the cell. You have your lumen, which is your cavity inside the vessel itself. And in this case, you notice that there's one erythrocyte, one red blood cell, making its way through the capillary. Okay, this is what prevents us from losing the red blood cells at the capillary depth, is the fact that there's only one that can fit down the capillary itself. So that one that can fit down the capillary is not going to be able to push out even when it's sinusoidal like this. Okay, and it's very much perforated. It's still going to be moving down a tunnel that it can't escape from. In fenestrated, you notice that there are these little fenestra. The fenestrations allow for perfusion of nutrients in and out. And then sinusoidal really allows for whatever it wants to move in and out, okay, except for your red blood cells. This is where you're going to have things like proteins and large molecules that are going to come across. They can come across through active transport in continuous. And they also can come across through some of the fenestra, depending on the size, and through active transport to the cells. But sinusoidal is going to allow them to move in and out freely. All right. So, capillary bed structure. Networks of capillaries running through tissues begin with arterioles and end at veinules. So, you have arterioles that go into capillaries. Capillaries come out the venous side and then become a venule. Precapillary sphincters regulate the blood flow. I've talked about them already a couple times. It allows you to clamp down that actual vessel itself and prevent blood from flowing through it to prevent main reason is heat loss. Okay. Meta-arterial is a vessel that is structurally intermediate between arterial and a capillary. There is the vascular shunt and true capillaries. Vascular shunt is a channel that connects the arterial directly to the venule. So you can shunt around the capillary. This is a vascular shunt. The true capillaries are going to be actual vessels involved in exchange. So you can push this through your capillary and then go through a thoroughfare channel to the venule. In this case, the thoroughfare channel for a vascular shunt is a shunt and it's pushing the blood around the capillary. It's not the best description in the world. Okay. So, this is going to be where you are going to have the sphincters contracted and it will bypass the actual capillary bed itself through a vascular shunt. This thoroughfare channel is where it is actually going to be considered part of the shunt. And then you have your meta-arterial, which is this first part of the shunt. All right. So this is the first type, which is vascular shunt. Does that make sense?
The bottom?
This is, they're both the same thing. Here's the catch. These are your precapillary sphincters.
The things that are attached to
the little things that look like snakes.
Okay.
Or bracelets. Those contract now.
Stop allowing you not to have blood flow through.
Yes.
Allowing it to.
So those are smooth muscle. The smooth muscle cells are going to clamp down. Okay. When they contract and clamp down, they force the blood through your meta arterial and through your thoroughfare channel.
Why do you want to do that?
Prevent heat loss. Yep, that's the main reason that I've always used to explain it.
When it's cold, that's what our that's when
we
activate.
Yep. Well, that's when you regulate them. Yes, there are other times when you will regulate them, but the main one that you always see and most of y'all are familiar with is cold weather. Okay. All right. So capillary exchange of gases and nutrients. So movement of substances into and out of the capillaries. So these are the different ways that you can move in and out. So there's direct diffusion through the membrane. Okay, only small charged particles tend to do this. Okay, just like in your cells, small charged particles are the only ones that tend to make their way through. So small polar, okay? Diffusion through the intercellular cleft. So you've got this intercellular cleft, which is a gap between the two cells. And diffusion through pores. So if it's fenestrated, it will go in and out of the fenestra. And then you also have your transport vesicles. So you can have your pinocytotic vesicles. The vesicles that are taking fluid and moving them from one area to another. Okay. So, anatomy of the veins. All right. So, it's going to carry blood from capillaries to the heart. So, this is your return system. You've got a postcapillary venule, veins, and then larger veins. So, it's as long as you understand the order, it's fairly simple. I have all tunics, but thinner walls, okay? Large lumens compared to the corresponding arteries because it is a low pressure system. Tunica media is thin, but tunica externa is thick. This tunica externa being thick is something that is what, like, it makes it harder for you to, with a needle, hit a vein in an artery. It's a little thicker, so veins sometimes roll. All right, so the thicker walls also allows for milking action to happen. I've mentioned it once before, so to say it again, the milking action is when you have the muscles that are right up against these veins, especially your larger veins. When you contract that muscle, you apply pressure to the outside wall of that vein, which increases the venous pressure. When you increase the pressure inside there, pushes it past the valve and moves it along. The valve's function is a one-way directional system, okay? Because you do not want backflow. If the valves in your veins fail, you tend to get swelling of the ankles, okay? That's where you will see that in individuals that have damaged their veins in some way, shape, or fashion. They will have, there are a lot of different ways you can do it, but they will end up having swollen ankles. All right.
Wait, I have a question. You said that the milking action is when the muscles contract next to the vein, and it increases pressure on the vein.
So, gut of it. And yourself. Okay? So, main. Okay, and my muscle's gonna be in purple. So I've got a muscle. When I say, it's a little bit, that makes sense. Okay, so if I've got a muscle that's right here, and it's elongated in this case. If I take and I contract this muscle, when it comes in this direction, all those muscle cells contracting is going to swell at the middle. When it swells at the middle, it's going to put a pressure outward in both sides. So when you put a pressure here, it's going to increase the pressure inside here because it's going to push against that. Does that make sense? So the increased pressure there is what's pushing it, and it will push it past the next valve. So when it opens up this valve, when it pushes it past the valve, it's gonna end up coming out. And then that pressure being increased, eventually gravity takes over. So gravity takes over and pulls it back down. When it pulls it back down, it's going to close that valve. And then you're going to continue to push longer. Does that make more sense?
The milking, I don't see it anywhere on the slide. We have to know that.
It's not in there because it's more of a physiology thing.
Okay.
But I'm just trying to say it so that way I explain it to you in that way. It makes sense why in the world valves are there. So now you know what the purpose is. You know what the purpose is? It makes it stick a little better usually.
So then are varicose veins a result of the muscles?
So varicose veins is, if I remember correctly, I haven't looked at it in a long time, but it's when the valve fails. So when valves start to fail in regions, you get the varicose veins. And it's, last time I looked, the cause of varicose veins was impact trauma. So, runners. That's runners, tennis, things like that. My landlord in Corpus Christi had varicose veins, but she was a tennis player, an avid tennis player. That's part of what led to it. I can't remember what the treat. I knew this about 3 years ago, and it's been a long time since I looked at it. I'll look it up. Okay.
So when did this situation happen?
When did what situation?
When exercising, the milking action.
Oh, this can happen anytime. Like, you're sitting in your chair, and you go to like shift around. You just so happen to contract that muscle and push it.
Increase pressure.
Yep.
And that's called milking?
They call it the milking action.
I still haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, no.
So I'm in physio right now. I'm going to have to ask about that one.
Okay, yeah, the milking action. It's in my anatomy and physiology slides for anatomy and physiology 1. So I talk about it there.
Okay.
And that's, I'm using both slides there. So.
That means pushing it along.
Yeah. It's what you're doing. It's like milking a cow.
Yeah.
You're grabbing and pulling, grabbing and pulling, grabbing and pulling. Well, that's what's happening here. So the muscle is pushing, pushing,
okay.
Pushing.
So the muscles push the veins and the valves aren't working in the blood flow. Is that when they pop out of the muscle? I'm looking at the next one,
Okay. So let's look at that real quick. This is what I'm talking about. So this is a diagram. I tried to draw it up here and it didn't work very well. But you increase the pressure, pushes it past the valve, right? So this is what I call milking action. So skeletal muscle pump is also how it's been referred to. But that's what's leading and creating that pressure. There's also going to be, like I said, smooth muscle in your tunica media. And that tunica media, smooth muscle can create pressure also to push it past these valves. Okay, less reliable, but, well, okay. It's the primary method, but it's not gonna create nearly the high pressure that the muscle milking will. Okay? All right.
So when you're putting it in your feet, well, is it because there's no, there's a backflow? It's not flowing nicely, there's backflow? Well, it is caused by a pressure in your weight.
So, more than likely, and this is speculation, I haven't looked at it myself, but more than likely it's because you have an increased fluid load and you're trying to also deal with not only your own blood and circulation system, but also the child at the same time. So you're going to have a higher pressure and issues with waste removal. So you're probably more than likely having a lot of interstitial fluid created there, and gravity is holding it down, and your lymphatic system can't keep up. So that's more than likely what's going on. But like I said, I haven't sat down and actually went through that. All right. So, all right. Special anatomical features. So there's a large lumen. Your venous valves I've talked about already. Particularly in limbs, that's where they tend to be for the most part. Main reason why they tend to be in limbs is because you do have the muscles there to actually be able to increase the pressure. Skeletal muscle pump, muscle milking, the muscles press against the thin walled veins and they end up forcing the fluid in both directions, truly, but with the valves it makes it to where it's mostly unidirectional. Respiratory pump, so the diaphragm is going to change pressure in the thoracic and abdominal cavities, which changes pressures in the veins. This also helps to push the blood, the circulating blood back. Venous sinuses, so flat and thin walls of the endothelium only. So the sinuses, when we get into So skeletal muscle pump, you see it on the left, I've been talking about it. The respiratory pump's a little different. So when you have changes in your thoracic cavity pressure, okay, you decrease the pressure, that means that it's lower than atmospheric pressure. If it's lower than atmospheric pressure, then the venous return blood can move up easier, because now it is a lower pressure than the pressure outside, so the pressure outside is actually pushing on you and forcing it up, okay? Then when your pressure inside your thoracic cavity increases, okay, you go to expel air or exhale. When you go to exhale, you're gonna force that out. You increase it above the pressure, the atmospheric pressure. When you do that, then you are increasing the pressure inside of those veins. When they end up pushing their way back in, they will push their way back into the inferior and superior vena cava into the right atrium of the heart. We're good. Okay. So, interconnections of blood vessels. So there's the arterial anastomosis. So they're going to provide the alternate pathways to ensure continuous flow, even if one artery is blocked. Common in joints, abdominal organs, brain, heart, and there are none in the retina, kidneys, or spleen. So this is to make sure that you do not lose blood circulation to vital organs. arterial venous anastomosis. So these are shunts and capillaries. They are going to be your meta-arterial thoroughfare channels. Okay, your venous anastomosis are going to be so abundant that, they are so abundant that blocked veins rarely prevent blood flow. Okay. Wish there was a picture. Okay. So, in this case, it's not the best picture in the world, but you can see it here. Arterial venosus anastomosis. So this is a connection between your artery and your vein side to prevent backflow. Okay, you do also have your thoroughfare channel and your meta arterial that are going to come together to create an anastomosis. There's one that's missing. Okay. So, as long as you know what anastomosis are, you should be okay in the general. Okay. So, in this case, now we're looking at circulation in an adult human. Okay, so you have your venous return into your right atrium. Once that venous return fills into that right atrium, the right atrium will contract. When it contracts, it's going to push blood into your right ventricle. When it pushes into your right ventricle, then your right ventricle, the valve will close, and then you're going to push it out through your pulmonary semilunar valve. Once you pull it out through your pulmonary semilunar valve, it is going to go through your pulmonary trunk, and then from there it is going to split off into your left and right pulmonary arteries. Your left and right pulmonary arteries are going to take it to your lungs, where it's going to pick up oxygen, give off carbon dioxide. It's going to bring it back into your left atrium. When it brings it back into your left atrium, it's going to contract, push it into your left ventricle, and then out through your aorta. Once it makes its way into your aorta, it goes to your system. That is where it hits all the capillaries, okay? That's where you have gas exchange happen. That's going to be where you are going to have waste picked up. That is where you're going to have nutrient exchange. That's where you're also going to end up picking up from your endocrine organs, hormones, and dropping them off somewhere else to signal. Good?
I have a quick question.
Yep.
After it picks up the oxygen, you said it kicks out the carbon?
Yeah, so you're going to want to, okay, blood chemistry and pH and all of that will be covered way more in depth than what I'm doing here in physiology. Okay. You'll have like a whole lecture dedicated to it. But yeah, it's going to, just in general, you're going to get rid of oxygen, or excuse me, you're going to take up oxygen, you're going to get rid of carbon dioxide, and when you have that exchange happen, you're going to try and make sure that you don't lose the pH balance that you have. Okay?
Okay, and then it
so
comes back in the
pulmonary veins, the veins?
So it's going to come back to pulmonary veins. Veins bring it back to the heart.
Got it.
Okay? Yep. All right. So, pulmonary circulation. So, the pulmonary trunk leaves the right ventricle. Okay. It divides into the right and left pulmonary arteries. Then it's going to hit a capillary bed. Then it's going to hit the venules and then the right and left pulmonary veins. Then it will hit the left atrium. So, that's a basic breakdown of what happens. It's going to carry deoxygenated blood to the lungs and pick up oxygen. Now, these veins and arteries and arterioles and venules are going to be intimately associated with the alveoli of your lungs. We're going to talk about those next when the pulmonary circuit comes around. So, in this case, what I mean by that, you're going to have capillary beds wrapped around a lot of these alveoli. These little alveolar sacs are thin-walled themselves. So they have a thin cellular wall, and then they are next to your capillary bed, which also has a thin cellular wall. So you've got two single cell thin walls that are responsible for gas exchange. Pretty much primarily that's all they do. There is some nutrient exchange, mainly because your alveolar cells do need nutrients themselves. Okay? All right, and this is probably one of the better pictures that I've seen that actually shows the association between the two, the bottom one on the right. All right, so when you look at this, you are going to have your incoming blood flow. Okay, it's deoxygenated at this point. It will make its way out to the capillary beds. It's the only time when you see a capillary bed color that looks backwards is at the alveoli. You're going to hit the capillary bed, and then all of a sudden it's going to become oxygenated. It's going to move its way back to an arterial and take it away from the lungs. Okay? Excuse me, my bad. Hit up venule. All right, so important differences between systemic arteries and veins. So arteries are gonna run deep, whereas veins are gonna be both deep and superficial. Veins tend to be easier to find in your cat. Deep veins share same name with corresponding artery, and superficial veins do not correspond to the names of any arteries. Part of the reason why is because when they were named, they did not see the association, so they were naming them based off of whatever they felt like they wanted to name at the time. So some of these veins have some odd names. Okay. Venous pathways are more interconnected. Veins can have more than one name, making venous pathways harder to follow. The brain and digestive systems have unique venous drainage systems. The brain contains dural venous sinuses, so you get these sinuses that make it even more interesting. And the venous system of the digestive system is going to drain into the hepatic portal system, which I talked about earlier, being something that would be a practical dead ringer question if we had triple injection. Yes, we don't. So, your cats are injected with red and blue latex for the veins and arteries, which makes them easier to find. If we had the tight portal system shown, it would be in yellow latex. I mean, depending on the manufacturer. There's one manufacturer that makes life difficult and does it in black. Okay. So, all right. Brain, arteries, and veins. So, in this case, you can see for the most part they seem to be paired. So you have your major veins that are going to drain the head and neck. You have your vertebral veins. You are going to have your external jugular, your internal jugular, your subclavian, so below the clavicle. Okay. You have your brachiocephalic vein. If you notice, your brachiocephalic artery and your brachiocephalic vein are roughly in the same place, same position. A lot of these circulatory pathways are going to be similarly named. Superficial temporal artery, superficial temporal vein. Occipital vein being a return for should be the occipital artery, which is not labeled over there.
It's there. Let's see.
There we go. So, my bad. All right. So, your brain, arteries, and veins. All right. In this case, you've got some interesting circulation. So you have the circle of Willis. The circle of Willis is something that you should probably understand. Okay? What the circle of Willis does, Circle Willis makes it to where you do not lose circulation to any region of your brain if one region shuts down. So that is the general gist. You want to try to preserve that circulation. So Circle Willis is something that I would understand if I were you. The basics of it is like I said, it creates a circle. So it's like a traffic circle for the blood inside your head. If blood comes in and it gets stopped down one artery, it can push around to another artery and hopefully supply at least the general region with some oxygen in the blood. Now, if there is a problem where you have a clot that is down one of those arteries, you're probably going to lose some brain tissue unless you can get to that clot fast.
Like a stroke.
Yes. Okay. So you have in here your vertebral artery, you've got your cerebral artery, your anterior cerebral artery, and your posterior cerebral artery. And you also have a middle cerebral artery. You notice a lot of cerebral here. Imagine that. All right. Why in the world would you have all of these lovely veins centered around this cavity in the middle? What's in that cavity? So the diencephalon, but what's next to the diencephalon? There's the Starship Enterprise that I talked about a while back. You've got your, what fluid do you store in that area? Cerebrospinal fluid, right? You store it in the actual ventricles. So you've got your first ventricle there. Okay. So that is another thing too to keep in mind is that you do have a fluid system there. And that allows for you to maintain that fluid system. All right. Yay. So, okay. This is where I am going to say this is going to be the pain in the rear end for this chapter. Okay. Artery site. Okay. I'm going to tell you, know the artery site. Most of the vein is the same. Okay. So if you know the artery site, most of the vein will come to be natural. Compare the two and figure out what's different. That way you only have to know about 70% of the material that's on these two diagrams, artery and vein side. Okay, these diagrams are fairly cut down. So, it gets worse than this, just to let you know. Okay, but this will give you the basics. So, look at the artery side first. This is the side that I would memorize first. Then I would move over to the vein side and do a comparison, see what's different. And you only have to look at what's different, okay? So this is where you will spend most of your time studying for this test and for the practical. On your practical, I do have one of these models in lab. And if I remember correctly, it's only the arterial side that's shown. So there you go. Your arterial side is what you probably should know for lab too. So, all right, so let me just kind of make a real quick trip back. This is what I want you to know. When I said it gets worse, this is what I mean, okay? So, this is the one you should know. This probably has a little more detail than what you need to know, okay? So, the one thing that I will say that you should probably look into, because one of my kids will make its way on the test, the lecture test, is the hepatic portal system. Okay? So, all right.
The hepatic what?
Hepatic portal system. I'll try and talk about it at some point whenever I get there. Okay.
So arteries, this one will be on the lecture and
Yep.
And then the paddock will be on lecture?
The paddock will probably be lecture, because you don't have to blood check the cats, and I can't be mean.
No.
Okay. So, all right. This gives you an idea of association. I would use this diagram to help you understand what is what, if you don't already understand it from the first diagram. All right, same thing here, it breaks it down more. In your cat, your large arteries and veins are easy to find. Your smaller ones are not. So, more than likely what I'll look at on a practical for this is things that change names, okay? Your limbs, your appendages. This tends to have arteries that change names. Okay. The subclavian artery in your armpit becomes the axillary artery. Down the side of your humerus, it's called the brachial artery. Okay. And then it splits right at your elbow and becomes the radial artery and the ulnar artery. And they're usually easily found in your calf. Okay. Also, your femoral artery is another one that tends to be easy to find in your cat. Your popliteal artery is in a specific place, okay? Under the cat, okay? So, you also have your anterior tibial artery and your posterior tibial artery. Those are usually harder to find, especially in your cats, okay? Because you've already been going through the muscles and some of y'all have cut those out, okay? Y'all have done better than any class that I've probably ever had with cutting on your cats. So we'll just say that. This is the other one. This is the one I would compare with the first diagram that I told you. Find the differences, and then all you need to know are the differences. Okay? So your subclavian, your brachiocephalic, those have the same name. Your axillary, your brachial, your basilic vein. So your ulnar and radial veins tend to all basically just all you're doing is changing vein and artery. That's it. The name is exactly the same. Okay. All right. Like I said, this one's quite a bit more detailed. Okay. So this is the one that you should know. All right, this gives you more association like I've said in the past. Now here we go, hepatic portal system, yay. Okay, it's a specialized part of the vasculatory circuit. So the hepatic portal vein is going to pick up digested nutrients from the GI tract. So this is where your nutrients come from the GI tract, and it's gonna deliver them to the liver for processing. It delivers them to the liver, so that way you can take out harmful substances. Nutrient-rich blood is then sent to the heart towards the pulmonary circuit where it's oxygenated, then it goes out to the system. So this is what makes sure the nutrients make their way into the blood. This is where you can increase or decrease your fat reserves. This is where you can ensure that you are not actually taking in toxic substances that can harm you. You will break them down in the liver, okay? So, it's fairly interesting in my opinion. All right, so you have your hepatic portal artery, which is gonna come into your liver. This is what supplies your liver with the oxygenated blood it needs. Then from your intestinal tract, you have your hepatic portal vein that cuts over to the liver, and then your hepatic vein, which is gonna take it back and circulate it back to the heart. Okay.
So notice too, right?
Yep, if you notice that this diagram kind of gives you an idea, there's a capillary bed here for your stomach and intestines. So it's picking it up around your small intestine primarily. From there, you get the hepatic portal vein, which takes it over to a capillary bed inside your liver now, where it removes this nutrients and toxins are going to leave to the liver cells. And then from there, you're going to send it back out to the hepatic vein and back to the heart. All right. So, like I said earlier, look, compare, right? The only ones that I want you to know for the lecture exam are the ones that are on those two diagrams of the full human from top to bottom. Okay? Artery and vein, you need to know. All right. So.
Did you already know the investment places?
Not yet. That's where I'm headed next. Because we covered lymphatic and cardiovascular. Yes. So, we've already covered the lymphatic embedded in. Now, for physiology, you're going to talk about the immune response. And that gets into all kinds of other fun stuff, or at least you should talk about it. Now, for your lymphatic system. The lymphatic system, you should be talking about the antibodies, the antigens, the cascade of cell production, plasma cells, all of that should be in physiology, in my opinion.
Yeah.
All right. So, respiratory. I'll just start the introduction and then we'll take a break. All right. So, you breathe, yay. All right. So, in real life, that would be kind of funny, wouldn't it? That'd be like end of the semester, professor's really just over it. Just you breathe, done. Okay. Get to the end of the slide. Okay. Yeah. No. So, all right. So the pulmonary circuit is going to develop. Like I said, a lot of this embryology stuff is just in here to give you an idea. If you're wanting to go down this field, if you're wanting to be there, okay, you in a neonatal unit, a development unit, birthing unit, any of those, you're going to have to know more of this. Okay, when does it develop? When does it happen? All right, so at the fourth week, the lung bud is going to develop eventually from the endodermal tube. The two branches to form respiratory tree, mesoderm around the respiratory tree becomes the blood vessels and the muscles and cartilage. So the alveoli are going to come in about 16 to 28 weeks. The alveoli are not going to fully function until after birth. Okay? That is when the lungs will be cleared by the birthing canal. So the pressure in the vaginal canal increases the pressure in the thoracic cavity of the child, forcing the fluids out. The fluids are forced out. Then when the child comes out, the thoracic cavity reshapes or reforms itself, decreasing the pressure inside, and the child takes his first breath. Okay? So it's actually a mechanical process of squeezing the fluid out.
So, because this is all based on going through the birthing canal, what about those that are delivered through C-section?
So, yeah, I've never looked at it. They go through and start doing CPR on the child almost. They start doing compressions. I've never actually seen anybody in there actually turn a child upside down and start hitting them. But, old school might have been something. Usually that's something that I would imagine they're going to have a process set up. And it's more than likely going to be compressions with the child turned over based on what you would do for CPR for an infant.
Okay.
Okay, something close to that is more than likely what I would expect. But so, natural birth, that's what's
going on. So in one shape or another, they're getting that type of pressure.
They're gonna
clear that.
Yeah, they're gonna have to actually apply. Plus, at that point, you have a rib cage that hasn't completely ossified yet. So, pushing on the child, that's also why CPR for an infant is not like with a human where you're taking, you take, if I remember right, it's one or two fingers and you're just pressing in your hand. Usually, if you think there's an obstruction, turn the child upside down and then do it to their back. Okay? So, good? Okay. Now, that's a good question I've never thought about looking up. The things that I'm going to spend my time looking up.
All these questions professor were asking.
It's good though. It shows me that y'all are actually engaged in the learning process, which is a good thing. Shows that y'all are curious and that if I can still spark that curiosity and put you to sleep at the same time, we're good. Okay? So, all right. Then I know it's just my voice, not the material. All right, so the main function of your respiratory system is going to actually be the exchange of gases. Okay, so the entire process of gas exchange in the body, so it is the only place in humans we exchange gases. Now, I say that because I'm going to go back to an animal too. Okay, frogs. Some frogs, they have a moist epithelium. Moist, actual epidermis that allows them to absorb gases. Okay, that gas exchange in frogs is kind of interesting and unique. However, you cannot absorb oxygen through your skin. Okay, it's too keratinized. So there's no way that you can pass oxygen through your skin. Good? Okay.
Why do they put you in a hyperbaric chamber?
So hyperbaric chamber is usually used for treating dive incidents. So
that doesn't have anything to do with your dermis,
it's
all pressure.
So, okay, hyperbaric chamber. Okay, Schmuckatelli goes down under the waterline. Gets say 80 feet. Okay, Schmuckatelli takes, and when he comes back up, hits the surface, but he hits the surface way too fast. So what's happened is when Schmuckatelli was down here, Schmuckatelli was breathing off of a scuba tank. That scuba tank is pressurized air. The pressure on the air at 80 feet, let me just make it 90, okay? At 90 feet, he's under 3 extra bars of pressure. So you're under 1 bar of pressure here, and 3 bars here, so it would be 4 bar total pressure. So at 4 bar pressure, the volume of that air is very different. So the change in the volume of the air that he's breathing in and out is so much different that if he rises so fast that the nitrogen doesn't have enough time to come out of his blood, nitrogen is going to end up forcing its way out of his vessels and into his tissues. And that perfusion will eventually end up, because the pressure changed, it goes from in solution to out of solution, and it's a gas. So he builds up nitrogen bubbles in all his joints, okay? This is commonly referred to as the condition called the bends. Mainly because if you come up too fast, you're going to be bent over and it's going to hurt and all your joints are going to itch and you're going to have issues and pain in your joints. It's really bad. Okay, if somebody comes up after a dive and they have like delusions or they are complain about pain in their joints or itching of their joints, they probably have the bends. If it's pain in their joints, you need to find a hospital really quick with a hyperbaric chamber. What they do with the hyperbaric chamber, this was the original use for it. Now they come up with all kinds of weird stuff. But they take and put you in this tube, hopefully with someone else that's not crazy, okay? because it gets kind of lonely in there, and also you don't want to be in there with somebody screaming. Okay? But they put you back in here, usually tell you to lay down, and they are going to increase that pressure up to the 4 bar that it was where you were at. They're going to approximate where you were at. And then they're going to, that's going to push all the nitrogen back into your blood system, into your blood. Okay? And then once it makes its way back into your blood, then you are going to slowly be brought back to 1 bar of pressure. And that gives you enough time to exhale all that excess nitrogen. So that excess nitrogen, if you come up slower, you exhale it naturally. This is why if you free dive or if you dive with scuba tank and something happens with your gear, they teach you to do a specific type of ascent to prevent the bends. The ascent that you do is the whole time while you're going up, you say, ah, or you go the whole way up, okay? And you're giving off gases as you come up. There's also what's called a 15-minute safety stop. So about 15 feet down, you're supposed to do a 15-minute safety stop for diving. Sorry, I know I'm going probably way too in-depth on this, but it's one of the things, I'm a rescue diver, so the general gist here is the 15-foot, or 10-foot, some people say, 15-minute stop gives you extra time to get all that nitrogen out so we don't have the bends. Okay, I saw her hand first, so.
So what happens if you like have to fly, like that, like you do a scuba and then you fly, because the pressure is different?
You can get the bends from that. And it can lead to really big time issues if you're gonna fly. There's a certain window of time, depending on your dive, the length of your dive, and the depth of your dive, and what gas you were using. So this is just on compressed air. If things change, so if you use what's called nitrox gas is what you use if you just want the most pleasant diving experience ever, but you're limited to about 33 feet. If you go below 33 feet, you start to have issues where you get loopy. But nitrox gas is just nitrogen and oxygen only. You're taking every other gas out. And you've slightly increased the amount of oxygen to 20. Sometimes they'll go nitrox up to 30% oxygen. And that's when you get into the, like, well, you know, 33 is probably as far as you should go. But if you fly after nitrox gas, if you went below the 33, you're going to have real big issues. Like, you'll probably be in a hyperbaric chamber or dead. They tell you, I think it's 8 hours is the general rule of thumb between dive and flight. I want to say it's 8 hours is a general rule. Don't quote me on it. Look at the dive tables. There are dive tables all over about this that tell you when you can and when you can't. Some people push it. I will never push it. I almost won't dive the day before I fly. And I've got to where I don't dive anymore. I just free dive and snorkel, and I don't have to worry about it at all. Okay.
I didn't answer my question.
Okay, cool. So, sorry that went way off register, but yeah, it's almost like I was waiting on that one, right? Okay.
Yeah, that's so, your wheelhouse. I never heard that story.
Yeah, so,
that
sorry. But that's, and I have to say, that's one of the most interesting things to me because Navy divers were the first ones to figure all that out. Yes, one of the few times when a Marine will say, yes, Navy figured it out. Okay? But they mapped it out. What ended up happening is they were, I'm going to go off on another tangent again. Okay? So they ended up actually taking and they sent people down in the big steel helmets that you've seen, the little flap that opens, right? So they send you down in this thing, and you'd be a recovery diver, you'd go down, they turn on an air compressor and there was a hose hooked to you and it pushed air into your helmet. So it constantly kept filling with air. And at the seams, the air would seep out. Okay, because the pressure would get high enough, it'd just push it out. When that happened, it was okay. You could do that. Well, they started finding that there were issues with the air not being clean. So Navy divers started dying because of it, started having lung issues because they were getting the oil from the air compressor and the moisture and any bacteria or mold that was growing in the filters was making its way into their breathing air. And when you breathe that for 8 hours a day, it kind of gets rough. Okay, so they found that was an issue. Well, then they started saying, oh, okay, well, now we'll clean it better. So they came up with all the cleaning systems and all the stuff that we use to this day. So went there and developed that. One of the first times that they started trying to figure out diving techniques, they took a big snorkel and they stuck it up on top of the water. And they said, hey, we can go down 8 feet down and use this big snorkel, right? There's a certain capacity that you have in your lungs. You have to be able to exchange every little bit of air in that tube plus the amount that you need to get into your lungs to be able to survive. So that's why snorkels are limited to a regulatory length. You can do a 4 foot long snorkel, but the likelihood of you surviving very long down there breathing off of a 4 foot long snorkel is not very good. Okay? Because you can only exchange, based on the circumference of the tube, you can only exchange about 5,000 milliliters of air. I think it's in here. We'll get to it in a minute. But it's about 5,000 milliliters of air that you can exchange total in your lungs. So if the tube length of the snorkel and the circumference make the volume above that 5,000, you'll never breathe any air that's not in that tube. So you just keep rebreathing your own air. They found that one out the hard way too, okay? So people start getting loopy, start getting to a point to where they pass out and they swim to the surface and they say, no, that ain't working. Well, there you go. So they're not getting new oxygen in. They were just rebreathing the oxygen that they were breathing out. Okay, so you start off at roughly 19 and then you knock it down on your first breath to like 16, 17, then you take it down your next breath to like 14 and that's all you pretty much got. After that, you're like starting to get a little loopy. So they figured that out. They figured out that there's a length to the hose. They can't go down with the air compressor because eventually the pressure of the water will collapse the hose, okay? And they turned around and started doing compressed air diving. They compressed it into a tank and said, here you go, here's your tank, go down. They went down and then people started coming up with the bends. So they had to come up with a hyperbaric chamber to fix it. Okay, so little solutions over time. Navy divers are the only reason why we can dive at all. So anyway, now I'm off that tangent. So, okay, back to this. So the main function, all right, so respiration is the entire process of gas exchange, pulmonary ventilation, gas transportation, and gas exchange. Supplies the body with oxygen needed at the cellular level. Why do we need oxygen? Well, that goes back into your cell respiration. If you do not have oxygen, you only go through glycolysis and you will create lactic acid. This is something hopefully you would have picked up in intro bio. If you do have oxygen, you can go through processes like the Krebs cycle and oxidative phosphorylation, okay? So those two processes are where you get most of your energy for ATP production. So it also allows us to dispose of carbon dioxide that cells create. So additional functions for your respiratory tract is going to filter, warm, and moisten the air. You have in your lungs moisture. That moisture is what you breathe out. You lose a lot of your water due to your respiration. So you are moistening the air. Are you moistening the air for everyone else? No, you're moistening it for yourself. Okay? You want to try and keep that layer moist, because in that moist layer you have surfactants. Surfactants are what allow you to take up gases out of the air you're breathing and put them into a fluid. So that surfactant's kind of like a soap. Soap is a surfactant, okay? But the surfactants in your lungs are not soap, so don't try and wring someone's lungs out and wash your hands. All right, so regulate blood pH. So you're going to use the carbon dioxide primarily to regulate the pH of your blood. The use of bicarbonate and carbonic acid. You are going to also use your respiratory tract to produce sound and to actually smell. Okay, so respiration has a lot of different functions. So you have the upper respiratory tract, which is going to be your nose, pharynx, and larynx. Your pharynx, you have the three regions. Have I talked about those in here yet? Don't think so. Okay, you should know them in the order that they're in. Okay, so nasopharynx, behind the nasal cavity. Oropharynx, behind the oral cavity. Laryngopharynx, associated with the larynx. So the larynx is below the pharynx. That's a way you can remember it. If you know those three regions, it makes it a whole lot easier to figure out certain things. Below your larynx, which your larynx is where your sound box is actually located. Okay, your vocal cords. Below that, you have your trachea. Your trachea is about a 4-inch long tube that goes down to your bronchial tree. It's your bronchioles. You have a left and right bronchi off of your primary bronchus. Your lungs. You are going to have inside your lungs, beyond your bronchial tree, you'll have the alveoli. The alveoli are where gas exchange is going to happen. Part of your anatomical portion of your respiratory system is going to be the muscle, the diaphragm. The diaphragm is what creates the pressure differences that allows you to breathe in and breathe out. Without it, gas exchange doesn't happen. Okay? So if you rupture that diaphragm, or if you damage that diaphragm in any way, shape, form, or fashion, you are going to have respiratory issues. We're going to talk about the unique structure here in a little bit. Alright, so functional divisions. Conducting zone. So the conducting zone is where you have gas movement. So it can connect the cavities and tubes that filter warm, moist, and conduct air into the lungs. Respiratory zone is the tissue that's going to facilitate gas exchange. So there is a region where you do not have moving air, however, you have gas exchange happening. So gases are moving down concentration gradients into your alveoli. And then from the alveoli, they're moving down their concentration gradient still into your bloodstream, okay, into the capillaries. All right. So, yay, bronchial tree. All right. So, you have your nasal cavity, you have your oral cavity. So, nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx, and then your larynx. Okay? Behind your larynx and trachea, you are going to have your esophagus. It's in the back. Okay? So, when you look at your cat, something that you should find in your cat, okay, is going to be your trachea. You should find your trachea. You should try to find your larynx and your voice box if you can. There's one group that literally they have the whole cartilage dome right here out of their cat, and you can see the vocal cords. Okay? Then behind that, you've got your esophagus. Okay? So if you look right there at the vocal cords, you can see the split between the two tubes. And that's what happens when you get something down the wrong pipe. When you get something down the wrong pipe, it more than likely hit back here and ricocheted in. because you have this lovely little structure called the epiglottis. The epiglottis, right here. And when you swallow food or drink, it usually collapses the epiglottis to cover the glottis. And it directs all of the food and drink down your esophagus. We good? Okay. So, all right. You have your trachea, which is about 4 inches approximately. It's below your larynx. It's 4 inches from right here at this juncture. Okay? You have the carina of the trachea, if I can speak to it. So, the right main bronchus, if you notice in the human and in your cat, it is slightly shorter on the right bronchus than the left bronchus. So, on your cat, if I ask you which one is right or left, you should be able to know based on just the length. Not to mention the fact that it's patients left, patients right. Okay? That's really simple, but if for some reason I was to be mean and just cut it out of the cat and throw it on there, you could probably do it that way too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, alright. So, you have your right lung and your left lung. Your right lung is going to have 3 lobes. Your left lung is going to have 2 lobes. Below that, you have your diaphragm. Notice that your diaphragm is arched. It is, in its relaxed state, arched. Okay? Your diaphragm, when you contract your diaphragm, because muscles can only do one thing, contract. That's it. So, when you contract your diaphragm, it straightens out. When it straightens out, it drops the pressure in your thoracic cavity. So that lower pressure in your thoracic cavity means that air will passively, as long as your mouth is open, air will passively move in to your thoracic cavity. Okay? You exhaling is active. So you are going to relax your diaphragm. Okay, well, they're both active because your intercostal muscles, but in this case, you relax your diaphragm, and that increases the pressure in your thoracic cavity, forcing the air out. Okay? We good? All right.
I do have a question.
Yes.
The caudal lobe, am I right about the caudal lobe that I see on the cat? Isn't that four lobes of the cat? Do we have four lobes of the person, too?
I think you're talking about the liver.
Am I talking about the liver?
You're talking about the liver. Okay.
Sorry.
The lobe liver in the cat is, yeah, that's where it's registering. That's what Joe was looking at the other day.
Maybe there's 5 there.
So
on the liver.
There was, if I remember right, in the liver there's 4.
Okay.
So in the lungs, there's 3 on the right, 2 on the left. Okay. So. And in the liver and the cat, there were 4 lobes, and that one weird lobe is kind of off on the back side. Yeah, that's liver.
Okay.
So, all right.
Sorry.
You're good. So, now you have your primary bronchus. So, this is the bronchial tree. Okay, this is a shortened or abbreviated version of the bronchial tree. So, you have your primary bronchus that's going to come in. You have cartilage rings that hold them open. Cartilage rings started back at your trachea. Okay, your trachea and your larynx. Your trachea has solid cartilage rings all the way around. Your trachea actually has C-shaped cartilage rings. Okay, so then you're going to have your secondary bronchus. Your secondary bronchus branches off your primary bronchus. Okay, then below that you will eventually hit your tertiary bronchi. And then below that you hit your bronchioles. Now, your respiratory zone is going to be your bronchioles, your respiratory bronchioles, your terminal bronchial, and your lobules, which is going to be your alveoli. The alveoli are grouped together in these lobules. They look like little bundles of grapes. Okay? Alright. So the respiratory epithelium is on the inside of your bronchioles, and then you do have smooth muscle there. All right. Now we get into more detailed pictures. All right, so I tend to like these diagrams, just a heads up. So in your nasal cavity, you are going to have the meatus. So you have the superior, inferior, and middle meatus, which is the gaps between your nasal conchae. Your nasal concha or conchae is going to be superior, middle, inferior. You will have the nasal vestibule. The nasal vestibule is just behind the actual nostril, or also known as the nares. Mainly in animals, they will call them nares. However, some doctors will use that term. In your oral cavity, you do have the tongue. The tongue is one of the largest muscles in this region. And it's interesting because of how you can stick your tongue out and muscles can only contract. So I think I brought that up at least once in here. All right. So you have a hard palate and a soft palate. Now, in your cat, I don't have tools to do this, okay? There is a way that you can disarticulate your cat's jaw, in other words, break it, okay? If you break the cat's jaw, you can rotate their mandible, okay, over. When you rotate it over, you can see hard and soft palate. You can also track it down. I'll dig around and see if I can find bone tools sometime today. So if I can find bone tools, we'll bust that open. I don't think there are any though. So I may just take someone's cat and make it the example. Okay? But when you break the cat's jaw, you can rotate it over, you see hard and soft palate. Hard palate has bone in it, soft palate does not. Really simple. Okay? Alright. You also have your uvula, which is going to be at the end, the terminal end of your soft palate. You have the three regions of your pharynx that I told you you should know. You also have your pharyngeal tonsils, okay? And you have your palatine tonsils, which are at the end of your palate. You have your lingual tonsils, which are at the end of your tongue, okay? These tonsils are going to be part of the lymphatic system that you're not gonna see in your cat from one. But they're part of the lymphatic system that is going to be isolated in of itself. It's not connected in the trap, okay? So those and also something called Peyer's patches. All right, so make sure I covered everything here that I want to. Okay, so the external opening, this is something that I'm gonna say so that way if you ever hear it, differentiate it. So there was a time when people differentiated between nostrils and nares in the human. The nostril opening or the nasal opening was always considered to be the opening you could see, and the nares was the opening you could not see, okay? The nares would be the opening inside. So take your finger and stick it up there and you feel around a little bit, you can kind of find where the opening might start. Okay, don't go past that though, because you might find that you'll pull your brain out. Okay, or at least that's what my mother always said. All right, so the nose anatomy, you have your external nares, their nostrils, okay? Like I said, they've kind of done away with the difference between the two. Nasal, frontal, and maxillary bones, plus hyaline cartilage. The nasal septum is the internal division. The septum is that cartilage piece that runs right down the middle. The septum is going to actually insert into the vomerine bone. Okay, the vomerine bone is the bone in the middle of your nasal passage, okay? Perpendicular plate of ethmoid bone and vomer. So It divides nose into left and right. This is what gets damaged if you get into a lot of fights and you have broken noses. This is what is damaged when you have a broken nose. This is also what gets damaged with certain types of recreational drug use. Okay? So you may see that in a clinic somewhere where somebody has a ruptured septum or they will have a deviated septum. So my septum, when I went in and had it checked, he said that basically I had 10% of actual air volume passing through the left side. So that's because Marine Corps, basketball, baseball, things hit me in the face, stuff like that. So you box enough and you end up fighting in martial arts and yeah, you end up with a deviated septum. So it can restrict airflow. So sometimes you have to kind of pay attention to that. If you have somebody that's a patient and they came in and they got severe trauma to their face and they already had a deviated septum, then more than likely there's a side of their nose they can't breathe out of. So if you roll them over on the only side they can breathe out of, they may start mouth breathing all of a sudden and start giving you problems when you're trying to work on it. So just keeping that in mind occasionally might help. Okay? So I say that from a person who's been in that boat before. Like, hey, quit putting my head on that side because I can't breathe. So, all right. So space inside the internal nose connects to the pharynx. Is the nasal cavity. So it is lined with pseudostratified epithelial tissue and goblet cells and olfactory epithelial tissue. The roof is the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. The floor is the maxilla and the palatine bones. Okay, conchae, I told you that there's superior, middle, and inferior. Okay, they are flaps. So you have these nice little flaps that help moisturize the air, that are going to help create less turbulence to make it to where you can bring this in. It's going to create a little bit of laminar flow. However, that laminar flow is going to come in contact with the already turbulent air, which is going to throw particles, like little poop particles, you smell someone fart, into the mucus inside your nasal cavity to catch it so that way it doesn't make it to your lungs and infect your lungs. Okay, so your nasal cavity does function to help prevent infections from making its way into the respiratory region of your lung. Okay, there's an advantage to it. So smelling someone's fart is better than breathing someone's fart. Okay, so all right, I gotta try something.
Remember that.
All right, so as bad as it sounds, all right, but the general gist here is that you should know that these actual conchae are making you able to have the laminar flow and they also give you more surface area inside your nasal cavity. Now, you have this olfactory mucosa and then you have these. This olfactory bulb that sits right here. And off this olfactory bulb, you have olfactory receptors. This is how you smell. So if you damage this, then you're gonna have issues smelling. This is where they had a couple years ago, a nasal spray, I forget which one it was like Zicam nasal spray, that if you took and sprayed it in your nose within a certain amount of uses, you would more than likely lose the sense of smell, at least temporary. Because what it was doing is as you sprayed it into your nose, it was coming in, the nozzle set about right here, you inhale and it kicks it right into your olfactory bulb. If you do this repetitively, you damage that olfactory receptor bed and eventually lead to damage of the olfactory bulb. So that's why they were bringing it up as a big issue, because they were damaging that permanently. Okay, we good?
Can you get addicted to those? My stepmom's been doing that ever since I've known her, and it's like, it's the one with the night, the N, the night friend, the friend, Sue friend, something, I don't know, but I'm just like.
I haven't heard
these
stories, but I'm just gonna tell you, I every night spray my nose with, what is it? It's the knockoff version, okay, it's the, yeah, the cheap one. But it's Nasonex, I think it is. No, not Nasonex. Flonase, there we go.
Okay.
I'm using Flonase every night at 7 p.m. because everybody that I've talked to has found that it actually works better when used at night. The nurse practic, yep, the nurse practic that gave it to me, she turned around and said that literally every evening you do this, you take this two sprays in each nose, you're good. That's all I'm taking right now. I used to be, so it's Flonase. It's the green top bottle, but I used it and I've been using it for at least 4 or 5 months before this class started. So I am worried personally about that happening. That's my biggest concern, is losing my sense of smell. So that's something that I don't think the studies have been long-term enough to be able to actually say that they won't do that. But everybody seems to say it's okay, and I'm just gonna keep going and get a lawyer. So, you good? Okay. So, nose and nasal cavity function. So, filtering, warming, moistening, incoming air, respiratory mucosa, it's gonna produce a mucus. The mucus is going to moisten the air, trap bacteria, and send them to the stomach via your throat. Yum. Okay. So, those poop particles I was talking about earlier, it's better to smell them than to breathe them. Okay. So, if you are smelling the poop particle, it gets embedded into the mucus of your nasal cavity. Eventually, going to find its way back down and roll down that soft palate into your esophagus, and then it's going to go down your esophagus into your digestive system, where it will be broken down. So, yes,
so
you just
a good idea not to go in the bathroom. Somebody blew it up afterwards.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, yep. So, that's I would avoid going in if somebody you know just blew it up. So, my youngest brother, I don't ever go after. Okay, so, all right, rich network of small veins is going to warm the air. So you have these small veins that are running through this nasal cavity region. It is going to help warm the air. This is also why they tell you when you're running in the winter to breathe through your nose and not out your mouth, because you will end up actually leading to a larger vapor loss, which is going to dry out your throat, make it to where bacteria can thrive, leading to infection. So they're going to contain nasal hair inside your nasal cavity, or inside your actual nares, your nostril region. It is going to collect and remove dust. Hair does not go past here, okay? Detect smell. So you have your olfactory receptors that I showed you earlier, and modified vibrations of sound for speech. It gives you another resonation chamber. Okay, that's why people sound different. The resonation chamber is different, the vocal cord's different, the larynx resonation chamber is different, and your mouth shape is different. That's why we all have different sounds. Okay, so paranasal sinuses. Yay, the things everybody hates that has allergies. So, hollow cavities within the skull bones associated with the nasal cavity. So there's frontal, maxillary, sphenoid, and ethmoid. Helps to lighten the skull, helps voice resonance, and secrete mucus. Okay. People always love to say that it lightens the skull. I'm just going to tell you, the amount of bone that's actually removed from these sinuses is not nearly as large as they like to suggest. Okay. So, for purposes of my class, the two things that really are the most important, however, all three are real, okay? So it does really lighten the skull, but that's probably not evolutionarily why they were kept, is voice resonance for sound production and being able to produce different vocalizations, which is really important for animals like dolphins. Okay, that's pretty much how they make all their pop squeaks and clacks. And to secrete mucus, because the mucus inside your nasal cavity is so important to you preventing infection and living longer. Okay, those are probably the two most important in my opinion. We're good? Okay. So the pharynx, it is a funnel-shaped passageway for food and air. Skeletal muscle is going to, skeletal muscle is lined with mucous membrane. The chamber for resonating speech contains your tonsils. So I talked about your tonsils earlier being part of your lymphatic system. All right, so like I said, there's a group that you can see the vocal cords on a cat. You can see the actual vestibule of the larynx and the epiglottis, you can kind of see. You have your laryngeal pharynx, you have your oral pharynx, your nasal pharynx, nasal cavity, oral cavity, the uvula at the end of your soft palate, and your epiglottis, which keeps you from having things constantly go down the wrong pipe. In your nasal pharynx, so your nasal pharynx is going to contain your pharyngeal tonsils at the very back of the cavity. Posterior to the nasal cavity and above the soft palate. It is only an air passageway. Okay, I beg to differ. It's primarily only an air passageway because laugh really hard and you'll put milk out your nose. Okay, so what is happening though? When that happens, that means it's a failure of your soft palate. So you have increased the pressure inside your oral cavity with that milk in it, and the soft cavity has more than likely everted and flipped up, allowing the milk to pass by. Okay? So, or the other one is if your soft palate did not evert, then what happened was your soft palate did not close off the nasal cavity like it was supposed to, and you forcing the milk back out was faster than this collapsed down. Okay? So, all right, pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. So, looks like it's got multiple layers and it's got little cilia on it, okay, in the nasal pharynx, because you want to make sure that you are moving things directionally down and out. Pharyngeal tonsils, they are located on the posterior wall, and it's going to destroy entering pathogens in this case. The oral pharynx. So the oral pharynx is arch-like entranceway of the oral cavity. Passageway for both air and food. Extends from the soft palate to the epiglottis. The epiglottis is the boundary for this. Stratified squamous epithelium, and you have your palatine and lingual tonsils here. Okay, palatine on the lateral walls, and lingual is going to cover the posterior surface of the tongue. Your laryngeal pharynx is associated with your larynx. Area that opens into the larynx and esophagus and is passed away from both food and air. This is where it gets differentiated, is your laryngeal pharynx. And it is differentiated by your epiglottis. Okay, so the cartilaginous structures that surround and protect the glottis are the larynx. So the glottis is the narrow opening in the larynx from where the air is going to move to the trachea. So there are three functions. One, it's going to provide an open airway. Two, it's going to route air and food to the proper channels. And you're going to have your voice production. So the vibrations of your vocal cords is what produces the initial sound waves. Okay? Going physics here for a minute, produces the initial sound waves. Then they are going to reflect off of your oral and nasal cavities, giving you what's called resonance. And that resonance is what leads to the differentiation of your voice from other people. Okay? Also, the tension on these and how you've learned to control the tension on those. So their voice production is very complex. All right. So the anatomy, thyroid cartilage is large anterior shield attached to the hyoid bone. Hyoid bone, free-floating bone. Okay, it's that little bone. It's on your practical. Okay, sorry. It's that little U-shaped bone that's just kind of off by itself, just kind of thrown out there. Yeah. All right, so laryngeal prominence is where two thyroid cartilage plates fuse. And then you're going to have your cricoid cartilages, inferior ring-shaped, attached to the trachea. And then you have your epiglottis, which is the leaf-shaped lid, posterior aspect of the tongue and thyroid cartilage. Arytenoid, cuneiform, and corniculate cartilage, so lateral posterior walls of the larynx. Okay. So we'll go through functions. All right, so your thyroid cricoid cartilages, they protect the glottis and entrance to the trachea. So thyroid cartilage in this region, then you have your cricoid cartilage right here. So your cricoid cartilage paired with your thyroid cartilage, front and back. Okay, they are protecting your voice box. They also provide a little bit of resonance. Your epiglottis. So your epiglottis is this flap of Palin cartilage that deflects into the esophagus. And then you have your arytenoid and your corniculate cartilages. Their function is going to be open, close in the glottis and assist with sound production. Okay, so you should know the basics of which cartilages are here. Your trachea, you should know that it has C-shaped cartilages. Okay, C-shaped cartilage rings. At the back, there is a muscle. The muscle will allow you to control. All right, so it'll control the diameter or the circumference. All right, so vocal cords. These vocal folds, okay, known as true vocal cords, are ligaments of elastic fibers. They create the mucosal folds. Air rushes up from the lungs, vibrates the vocal cords. The tension on these can change, like the tension on a guitar string. If you've ever tuned a guitar, you know what you're talking about here. You strike the cord and you turn the knob, tightening or loosening the cord. This is the same thing that you are doing to change the actual tension on the vocal cords. You're pulling on it using the muscles. Now, if you, as a child, you start to learn how to control that tension, okay? So a lot of your inset ability, your brain synapses and processes are formed to control it a specific way. Sometimes it's regional, okay? It's where I go into why I can't speak Spanish. I can't roll my R's to save my life. And if you didn't learn how to roll your R's by a certain age, you more than likely you're not going to be able to roll your R's. So it's kind of interesting to think that it's such a learned process that's ingrained and left in for pretty much ever. Okay, just a heads up. So, all right, the vestibular folds. These are the false vocal cords. The vestibular folds, they're going to be outside, okay? So the vestibular folds, they're going to be the mucosal folds superior to the vocal folds. They help to close the glottis during swallowing to prevent you from getting something down into your bronchioles. Okay. The trachea. So descends from the larynx into the mediastinum. Anterior to the esophagus, the carina is going to be inferior tracheal cartilage histology. This is where we get into what the slides are going to look like. Okay, so the mucosa is ciliated, pseudostratified with goblet cells. What do goblet cells look like? Goblet cells. So, when you're looking at a slide, if you've got a good cross section of a goblet cell, it looks like a goblet you would drink out of, upside down. Okay, this being the stem, okay, and this being the actual goblet. Okay, so that's a goblet cell, just in general, what it looks like. When you see goblet cells, you don't always see them sectioned correctly, because usually their width is usually larger than the width of the section that I'm taking, if I'm making a slide. So when you look at the goblet cells, they're going to usually be this cavernous opening. Okay, that's what I will try to depict if I'm putting it on any practical. All right, so submucosa is going to be the connective tissue and the seromucous glands. Hyaline cartilage is going to be C rings in the trachea, 16 to 20, that help keep the tube open. The smooth muscle supports the tracheal cartilage, closes the circle of the C-ring, helps adjust airflow into the lungs, and the adventitia is the outer connective tissue layer here, okay? All right. All right. I like this picture mainly because you can see the difference between thyroid and the cricoid. Okay. Cricoid, carotid, cricoid, coracoid, coronoid. You notice there's a lot of these that sound similar. Okay. This is one thing that if on the last practical you didn't pick up on it, I'm telling you now. Okay, make sure that you have the correct spelling on those, because a lot of times you tend to put like coronoid for cricoid, and those are two different terms, okay? So you're telling me one thing instead of the other. That's where spelling really comes in. All right, you have your tracheal cartilage rings, you have your annular ligament in between. So your right and left main bronchi. So the trachealis muscle is the muscle I was talking about earlier that you can use to vary or change the circumference of the trachea itself. Okay? On the inside, you're going to have the submucosa with the seromucous glands in the submucosa. Then you're going to have your hyaline cartilage ring outside, and then above that you have the connective tissue adventitia. When you look at a section, and this one I do not think I have sections of at all, okay, even in the lab. So in this case, you can see the trachealis muscle here that connects those two ends of the C-shaped ring to the trachea. You have your mucosa, your submucosa, and your tracheal cartilage is in there. Now, let me picture if I need to change things. All right, so when you take and look at a small section off of this, you're going to have, of course, your lumen. This is the opening where it's going to pass through. But then you have your mucus layer on top of your ciliated cells. Your ciliated cells are mainly moving the mucus down to your esophagus, okay? Or up to your esophagus, depending on where they're at. Then you're going to have your pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium with your basement membrane. Your basement membrane is just a thin layer of connective tissue holding it together. Then you have your lamina propria. So, lamina propria is the layer that's going to support the basement membrane. This is where we get into the histology side of things a little more. Below that, you have your submucosa. I would know the layers. Okay?
Know the layers on?
Yep. Know the layers of the tracheal tissues. So, from lumen to submucosa.
Okay.
Yes.
Are those, is that a goblet cell?
So, these would be goblet cells right here.
Okay.
Alright, so the bronchial tree. Alright, extensively branching respiratory pathways. Primary bronchi is the largest. The first branch off is off of the trachea. And the right is wider and shorter than the left. Part of the reason why is because of the position of your heart. So the position of your heart determines where your trachea is going to be. So if you have to shift that trachea just off to the side, that's why. Because now the heart's in the way. Secondary bronchi. So one per lung lobe. There's three on the right and two on the left. So that means that there are three secondary bronchi on the right of the individual and two on the left of the individual. Tertiary bronchi, they're going to branch off secondary. So every time you get a branch is where you change names. Bronchioles, little bronchi, they are less than 1 millimeter in diameter. So that is a characteristic that you use to define them. Bronchioles are less than 1 millimeter in diameter. Terminal bronchioles are less than 0.5 millimeters in diameter. So between one and 0.5, you have bronchioles. Below 0.5, you have terminal bronchioles.
You can know all these?
Yes. You should be able to know the general trend and characteristics of the bronchial tree. Okay. So, I love this diagram that's colored. Okay, it gives you an idea. You have your main bronchi right and left. Okay, then if you notice, the color hits right to the branch. Okay, so where it branches is where the name changes. Same thing with your veins and arteries. Usually, where they branch or when they cross into another region is when they change names. Okay, so then, if you take and look, you'll get your left and right segmental bronchus, which is going to be, in this case, yellow, okay? And then your smaller bronchi. All right. So, I've already went into quite a bit of this already, so I'll try to make it brief. Cartilage, the rings become irregular plates. Walls of the tube contain elastic fibers, so these elastic fibers allow it to stretch and move. Epithelium, so pseudostratified columnar, okay, columnar and cuboidal. This is how they are changing the epithelial type as you go down the bronchi. Okay, so primary bronchus is going to actually be pseudostratified columnar with cilia, okay? And then it's going to trail off the cilia to be the pseudostratified columnar, and then you will hit columnar, okay? Columnar is probably, if I remember correctly, around your secondary bronchus. And then cuboidal is when you're getting into your tertiary and your terminal bronchioles. Mucus cells and cilia are reduced to bronchioles. Or they're reduced in bronchioles. So, the smooth muscle is going to increase the passageway to become smaller. So you get more smooth muscle as it becomes smaller. Why in the world would you want to do that? Not necessarily capillaries, but if you have a conducting air passageway and it's getting smaller, you have less cartilage and you're increasing the muscle. What does that allow you to do? Control. just like in your veins. You have that control to constrict or dilate the tube. Okay? All right. So, respiratory zone consists of air exchange structures. It begins with the terminal bronchioles becoming respiratory bronchioles. The terminal bronchial, respiratory bronchial, and the alveolar ducts, then to the alveolar sac and the alveoli themselves. Okay, so someplace where it tends to get confusing. So, the alveoli itself is this little circular open. Now, the alveolar sac itself, okay, is this whole alveolar sac. The alveolar sac is where you are getting collected alveoli. The collected alveoli have openings that open them to each other. Okay, so the little grapes are not individual grapes. The grapes are actually connected to each other with openings. Okay? So sometimes the little grape analogy doesn't work so well. So that's why I'm explaining that to you. The alveolar ducts are the ones that lead directly to the alveoli. In this case, you can see them here. From your alveolar ducts, they will collect into a respiratory bronchiole. The respiratory bronchiole will eventually come into a terminal bronchiole, which will eventually come into a bronchiole. So this branching gives you more surface area, gives you more control. It also gives you a larger surface area for gas exchange because you want to get in as much oxygen as you can, especially since you are tidally ventilated. In other words, you bring in air and it comes out just like the tide. Okay? So alveoli, epithelial cells surrounded by fine elastic fibers and pulmonary capillaries. Connected by alveolar pores and the respiratory membrane. You have a couple different cell types. You have type 1 of the alveolar cells, which is simple squamous. Type 2 is simple cuboidal. So the alveolar pores for your simple squamous are going to connect one alveoli to the other. The alveolar type 2 is going to be the septal cells, and these are going to secrete the surfactant that you need to make sure you can actually prevent your alveoli from collapsing and sticking together, okay, and to allow for gases to go across the membrane. Without the surfactant, you can't get gases in, and your alveoli collapse on themselves, okay? Alveolar macrophages. So, part of your immune system, you have your innate immune system. It is going to have macrophages embedded in your alveoli to remove the infectious pathogens. Macrophages are not specific. They take out foreign bodies. That's what they do. Okay? And they reside in special places inside your body, one of them being your respiratory pathways. Yay. Alright, so this will be it, and I'll stop. Okay, so you can see here the alveoli, you can see all of the structure. I'll let you look through that. The one thing that I do want to point out is the alveolar macrophages and the two cell types. So there's type 1 cell, which is going to be the simple squamous, and then type 2, which is going to be your cuboidal. Okay, your cuboidal is where you get your surfactant from. Your macrophages will move around and they do lead to the protection of your alveolar cells. Good? Okay. So, there's only 8 more slides left for next time. All right. So, I will see y'all in lab. I ended right on time, so I'll start the lab on time. Okay? So 11:30.